This Week in Palestine offers news from a Palestinian perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees.
You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is This Week in Palestine, and I am your host, Ann Lucas. It was 7 months ago that Matt Carthy of the Sinn Féin Party in the Republic of Ireland gave a speech where he said, and I quote, "In our thousands and our millions, we are all Palestinians. In our thousands and our millions, we are all Palestinians." And so a new chant for Palestine was born. Carthy's reference is certainly tied to the histories of occupation that both Ireland and Palestine share. But here in the United States, thousands and millions have been learning the hard way about what it means to be a Palestinian from a somewhat different angle. Many are directly experiencing for the first time the Palestine exception when it comes to free speech. The United States is all free speech and First Amendment rights, and God bless America for that, until it comes to speech about Palestine and Palestinian liberation. Speaking about that and genocide in Gaza over months has gotten people repeatedly arrested and assaulted. People have lost jobs, been denied work raises, and even job positions for speaking against the genocide in Gaza. We are living in a time when even the smallest non-confrontational statements against the mass killing of children can get you in big trouble in America. I often say that we are through the looking glass when it comes to free speech these days. What's down is up, what's up is down, what's backwards is forwards, what's forwards is backwards, and all because there is so much speech about Palestine and the Palestinians. Of course, Palestinians and their long-term advocates here in the U.S. could have told you this is the case and has always been the case. But now it is truly in our thousands and our millions. We are all beaten, arrested, fired, and just in general silenced for being on the side of Palestinians. For this show, I have two pieces I want to share that address the how and the why of the Palestinian exception. In the first half of the show, we will look at the how. I want to share an interview with Josh Rubner done recently on This is Palestine with Diane Boutou. He will be talking about current anti-Palestinian legislation in Washington. This legislation very much seeks to codify all kinds of exceptions to free speech when it comes to Palestine or Israel. For the second half of the show, we will look at the why, namely Zionism and political influence. To that end, I will share a section of a book release event that happened this past week for the title Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic. This is an amazing historical reference for understanding how Zionists developed and cultivated massive political lobbying operations in the U.S. and Europe, which continue to be functional today. So, yalla bina, let's go. Diane Boutou recently interviewed Josh Rubner for This is Palestine, and it initially aired on June 11, 2024. Josh is taking on a new role as the director of the policy project for the Institute for Middle East Understanding. In this capacity, he speaks about current anti-Palestinian legislation in the works in Washington, what it means, and what it will take to turn back this wave of blatant First Amendment violations. He also speaks about the work of the IMEU policy project going forward.
One of the things that being in Palestine that I don't really get to dive deep into is all of the pieces of legislation, bills, I mean, you name it, that is being pushed through Congress, particularly most recently. Can you talk me through it and help me understand at least some of the pieces of legislation that have been introduced by members of Congress that are targeting Palestinians and Palestinian rights advocacy? I know there's a lot, but so anything that you think I need to know at this point in time.
And there's just been a flurry, an avalanche of anti-Palestinian legislation that's been introduced and in many cases passed by Congress over the past 7 months of Israel's genocidal attacks against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. I hardly know where to begin, but I think the most important piece of legislation that was passed over the past 7 months was Congress giving Israel an additional $14.1 billion in weapons, the same type of weapons that are being used on a daily basis by Israel to commit these war crimes and crimes against humanity that we see every day. So that's certainly been the piece of legislation that's had the most tangible impact on Israel's ability to perpetuate these attacks. But as you mentioned, there's also been a ton of legislation introduced that's also very anti-Palestinian in its intent, especially the ability of people and organizations to speak out and organize on behalf of Palestinian rights in the United States. We're seeing this really McCarthyite attempt by the Education Committee in the House of Representatives to haul before the committee under oath different university presidents and really grill them for why they're not doing more to crack down on students' rights to engage in free speech and protest in support of Palestinian rights. And it's really something I don't think that's been seen in the United States and its intensities in Congress since Joe McCarthy in the 1950s, hauling people before his committee. The environment is really, really that hostile for people in the United States speaking up in support of Palestinian rights amongst some members of Congress right now.
So, Josh, help me understand in terms of the money, $14 billion, that's more than any other country gets?
I'd say it would be more than any other country. Up until a few years ago, really, the United States has poured a huge amount of weaponry into Ukraine to fend off the Russian invasion. So up until 2 years ago, that would be correct. But Ukraine is currently the leading U.S. recipient of U.S. weapons, but Israel is in general the leading recipient. And this $14.1 billion that Israel got a few months ago from Congress is a huge increase over the annual amount of weapons that the United States provides to Israel. So recently, the Congress also passed the regular $3.8 billion in weapons to Israel. So in recent months, Congress has funded Israel with nearly $20 billion worth of weapons. So it's a huge, huge increase over the usual huge amount of weapons that are sent.
So that $20 billion, you know, there's a difference, obviously, between Ukraine and between Israel. Ukraine is, of course, a country. It's a state. Palestine is not. And so the weapons are presumably not being used in this, quote unquote, defensive way that the United States is supposed to be using them. So is there a mechanism for any of the weapons that are being used?
That's a great question. And there are lots of conditionalities imposed in U.S. law on any country receiving U.S. weapons. So, for example, the Foreign Assistance Act says that recipient country of U.S. weapons cannot use them to commit gross pattern of systematic human rights abuses. And also it mandates the cutting off of all weapons if a country blocks U.S. humanitarian aid, which Israel is clearly doing in terms of U.S. humanitarian aid not being able to reach the beleaguered Palestinian population of Gaza Strip. In addition, the Arms Export Control Act says that country receiving U.S. weapons can only use them for legitimate self-defense and for internal policing, internal security. So it's quite clear that Israel is in very manifest breach of these laws. And members of Congress, some members of Congress, have been using these laws to try to press the Biden administration to cut off weapons to Israel because they are being used in these manifestly illegal ways, according to U.S. law and U.S. policy. And it was this push by members of Congress to try to impose more conditions on weapons to Israel that led President Biden to issue his National Security Memorandum 20 earlier this year, in which he was supposed to get assurances from countries that they wouldn't use U.S. weapons to violate international humanitarian law. They wouldn't use U.S. weapons to block U.S. humanitarian aid. And the Biden administration just released this report to Congress saying that, well, there are clear indications that Israel is violating international humanitarian law, and they've clearly taken steps to block U.S. humanitarian aid in the past. So logically, the conclusion is that even according to the Biden administration's own weapons transfer policies, Israel is not eligible for these weapons any longer. Yet, of course, the Biden administration acted in a very cowardly way and refused to draw the conclusions that were necessary according to its own findings and hold Israel accountable and cut off weapons. So the weapons continue to flow despite Israel's blatant violations of U.S. law and policy.
You also talked about these McCarthy-style hearings on regarding these protests on U.S. campuses. How is it that they're able to do this and why?
Well, Congress has vast powers to subpoena people, to subpoena organizations for any purpose that they want. And Virginia Fox, who's the Republican chair of the Education Committee in the House, is using that congressional privilege and prerogative to drag all of these university presidents through the halls of Congress into her committee and having to answer for the fact that there are student protests taking place on their campuses. But, you know, instead of investigating why police and pro-Israel mobs have been attacking student demonstrators and campuses have been failing to protect their students, these Republicans are trying to flip the script and somehow say that these university administrators need to do more to crack down on the First Amendment protected rights of students who are protesting against Israel's genocidal actions in Gaza. And it's really unbelievable when you think about the fact that students have taken over campus buildings in the past, engaged in encampments to protest U.S. support for apartheid in South Africa, to protest U.S. involvement in the war in Vietnam. These are all tried and true tactics of student protest. And yet here, when it manifests itself in the case of Palestine, we see just how afraid members of Congress are of these campus protests, because they understand that these student leaders on campus today are going to be the leaders of U.S. society and U.S. politics more broadly in coming generations. And they see the same public opinion polls that we see, that the youth in the United States are overwhelmingly supportive of Palestinian rights. And so they're trying in this very, very desperate way to crack down on the manifestation of this support for Palestinian rights among the youth.
Congress is also doing a lot to make sure that Israel doesn't face any consequences. Can you talk to me a little bit about some of the mechanisms that are used by Congress to make sure that Israel's not held to account?
Well, one of the things that Congress has been attempting to do is to try to prevent the Biden administration from even taking the most minimal steps towards halting weapon shipments to Israel. The Biden administration did take action in that regard to halt approximately 1% of the weapons that have been delivered to Israel since October. But the House of Representatives have even been trying to constrain the Biden administration's attempt to withhold anything at all by passing resolution that would basically force the hand of the Biden administration to deliver weapons, even when those weapons deliveries are being done in violation of U.S. law. So that's just one of the many ways in which Congress is attempting to keep the flow of weapons open to Israel at this point.
What about this ICC stuff? You know, I saw the title of this act. It's called the Illegitimate Court Counteraction Act. Can you tell me a little bit about this Illegitimate Court Counteraction Act, why it's called that, and what the Biden administration's take on it has been?
Well, unsurprisingly, this is a messaging resolution that was introduced by Republicans and supported by the Republican leadership and rushed to the floor, even outside of the normal procedures for bringing something to a vote in Congress. In other words, it bypassed the relevant committee in the House so that it could be voted upon really, really quickly. And what this resolution would do would be to reimpose Trump-era executive order sanctions on the International Criminal Court for investigating, quote-unquote, the actions of allies of the United States, which is an obvious reference to the ICC's investigation of Israeli actions, which, as you know, have been going on for several years now. Initially, Secretary of State Blinken testified before the Senate that he was willing to work with Republicans on a bipartisan basis to try to reestablish some form of sanctions regime against the ICC, which was overturned by the Biden administration when it entered office. Subsequently, the Biden administration reversed its course and said it was not the appropriate thing to do to sanction the ICC, despite U.S. policy differences with it. But nevertheless, despite the fact that the Biden administration opposed placing sanctions on the ICC, you still have 42 Democrats vote with the Republicans on this messaging bill to sanction the ICC for its investigation of Israel and its request for arrest warrants. So what this goes to show you is the extent to which some Democrats are still willing to cross partisan lines and side with the Republicans over and above their president in an election year. It's just astounding the lengths to which some of these Democrats will go to even object to something that is not being supported by the president himself.
Listening to you, I can hear just how deep this anti-Palestinian racism is in Congress and in U.S. policy. And why is that? Like, what accounts for this deep-seated racism? And how does this permeate into U.S. policy?
Well, first, let's start with the good news. The good news is that there is a growing informal caucus of members of Congress who are very supportive of Palestinian rights. The bad news is, yes, there is a deep-seated anti-Palestinian racist sentiment, both in the United States Congress and in U.S. society writ large. The question is why, and I think that's one that can be answered on several different planes. First of all, as scholars such as Stephen Salaita, Amy Kaplan, and others have pointed out, there are incredible similarities between the settler colonial experience of the United States and that of Israel. And of course, the United States was premised, and its settler colonialism was premised on biblical notions of conquest and how the European settler colonists who drove out and committed genocide against indigenous people in North America were very much inspired and motivated by these biblical verses in which they found justification. And they very much viewed themselves as creating a new holy land here in this continent. So when the opportunity came to promote modern day Zionism, that coincided with this resurgence of what's called restorationism amongst many Christians in the United States, which in short, is the belief that the Jewish people need to be restored to the Holy Land in order to hasten the coming of the Messiah. So you have all of these biblical and religious justifications and undertones, helping to prop up U.S. support for Zionism. But it's more than that. You know, I think in the modern day and age, the United States has viewed Israel as a child, as their progeny,
And Michelle Mart, for example, in her book, Eye of Israel, talks about how the United States often talked about giving birth to the state of Israel in 1948 through its instantaneous recognition of the country. And so there's always been this kind of fondness amongst many people in the United States for Israel. And I think a lot of people see the actions of the United States in committing genocide against the indigenous people of this continent vindicated and justified and explained by what Israel is doing to the indigenous Palestinian people.
And especially now, Josh, I'm sure you've heard this, but people who are coming out of Gaza are not just describing this as Israel's genocide on Gaza, but Israel-U.S. genocide on against Gaza. Israel has been shielded in Congress from criticism, including from criticism at the level of students at universities. Can Congress play a role? A positive role, that is.
Of course they could. They have the authority to cut off weapons to Israel. They have the ability to pressure the Biden administration to demand an immediate ceasefire. And all of these things have been done by dozens of members of Congress. And there is evidence that these congressional initiatives have put pressure on the Biden administration to at least modify its rhetoric, if not its actual policies. So, yes, Congress can and should do more, but they're actually doing the opposite. They're taking the very minuscule attempts that the Biden administration is making to curtail some weapons deliveries to Israel. And let's not make too much of a big deal out of the weapons that the Biden administration has paused to Israel.
You know, just the other day, we saw the horrific videos that came out of Rafah, where Israel had bombed an area that is supposed to be a safe place. And we saw, we literally saw children incinerated in tents. I mean, these are videos that I don't think will ever leave my mind. The Israeli prime minister came out after much criticism, of course, like he's done in the past, to say it's a quote-unquote tragic mistake. And at the same time, we've heard the Biden administration say that Rafah is a red line. Do you see that the Biden administration is going to do anything about this? Or is it that, given that he made that earlier statement of holding back 1% of the weapons, that we see that Congress is going to push ahead and make sure that there are no red lines?
I think it's pretty clear that Israel blew past President Biden's so-called red lines. The notion that the Israeli attack on Rafah is limited in any sense of the word is just a complete misunderstanding of what's actually taking place. More than a million Palestinians who were sheltering in Rafah have been forcibly displaced yet again where Palestinians were sheltering. And the evidence that I saw indicates that this was a small diameter bomb that was provided by the United States to Israel. So when you talk about Palestinians who have fled Gaza, talking about how the United States is a co-conspirator in this genocide, that's absolutely the case. The bombs that are being dropped on Palestinians in Rafah are U.S. weapons paid for by U.S. taxpayers. And so the question is, will the Biden administration now take the action that is demanded of it because Israel has defied the president's red line and actually cut off all forms of offensive weaponry as he pledged to do if Israel should go forward with a major attack on Rafah? So far, the indications is that the Biden administration will do what it's done over the past 7 months, which is nothing, and will continue to fund and provide the weapons needed for Israel to continue this attack, now in defiance of the International Court of Justice's demand that Israel stop it.
So, Josh, you know, what is it that U.S. citizens can do You mentioned what should be done, but is there a role for U.S. citizens? What can they do?
There's a lot that U.S. citizens can do. We do elect this government that passes these laws and makes these decisions, so we are responsible for the decisions of the U.S. government. And I think it's also important to note that Americans have, in unprecedented numbers and ways, manifested their objections to U.S. policy over the past 7 months. We've seen historically large protests, not only in Washington, D.C., but throughout the country, opposing U.S. support for Israel's genocidal actions. We've seen unprecedented numbers of constituents calling and writing and meeting with their members of Congress to demand an immediate ceasefire, to demand an end to weapons to Israel. And these efforts definitely are impacting congressional calculations. The pressure is working. Unfortunately, we're up against a very well-organized, well-funded lobby that exists for the purpose of providing Israel with weapons. We've seen AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, come out with a pledge to spend $100 million to defeat progressives in Congress who are speaking up for Palestinian rights. So we have a very corrupt political system, Deanna, in the United States, where money plays just an inordinate and outsized role in our politics. The Supreme Court opened up the possibility of wealthy citizens spending an unlimited amount of their fortune on attack ads. So you can have one person or a few people, you know, funding millions and millions and millions of dollars of attack ads. Don't even mention Israel, by the way, to try to get the members of Congress out of office who are speaking up for Palestinian rights.
I also was reading that Congress is taking action against UNRWA. Can you talk me through this, given that my understanding is that the United States is one of the largest donors to UNRWA, and what impact that's going to have?
Historically, the United States has been the leading funder of UNRWA since its establishment in 1949, roughly providing half of the organization's overall budget. So the Biden administration on its own decided to halt funding to UNRWA after there were allegations that were debunked by Israel about UNRWA employees' participation in October 7th. Most other countries have reinstated their funding to UNRWA because of the debunking of this story. But the Biden administration not only did not lift its ban on funding UNRWA, but Congress took it a step further. In the same bill that we talked about, where Congress gave Israel $14 billion more in weapons, Congress also imposed a one-year ban on any funding for UNRWA that may be renewed in 2025. So the important point is that even if the Biden administration wanted to reverse itself and wanted to restart funding to UNRWA, Congress has now made that an impossibility, at least until the spring of 2025.
So, Josh, I want to pivot a little bit and ask you about the IMEU's policy project now. Can you talk a little bit about that? It was recently launched. And so can you tell our listeners what they need to know about it?
Yeah, we've seen, for example, how in this election, one really critical component of how people are evaluating their vote for the president is on the Biden administration's policies of supporting Israel's genocidal actions in Gaza. And we're seeing how this issue is having huge ramifications in terms of Democratic public opinion and the willingness of Democrats to vote for the president in 2024. So the IMEU decided to launch this new policy project, which, as you noted, is a C4 organization, to allow us to delve into some of these partisan and electoral considerations that are off limits to 501c3 nonprofit organization. So what we're doing at this point is we're providing a lot of policy analysis and memos to members of Congress to help inform their policymaking. We're also sending a weekly newsletter to members of Congress and other decision makers in Washington, D.C., that summarizes the developments related to U.S. policy as it affects Palestinian rights, you can go to our website, imeupolicyproject.org, to find all of the latest on this.
Many thanks to the IMEU. This is Palestine and Diane Boutou for all the great work they do. I feel a little weird sharing Ilan Pappé's work so soon after I shared part of a talk he gave 2 weeks ago. I actually forgot he had a new book coming out that would directly speak to one of our show's major concerns, which is information to improve and encourage Palestinian activism. And this is why we have him back so soon. The book he has just released is called Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic. It is a work of history, but also a kind of reference book to understand how and why Zionism is so intertwined with structures of power in the United States and Europe. He had a book launch event in London last week and made comments about the book. As he notes, it's a very long book, and I am hoping this short listen can help you understand what makes it both an important read, but also an interesting read. And with that, this is Ilan Pappé.
I wanted to write this book because of a conundrum that really interested me and intrigued me over the years. How come a state that is declared to be a high-tech state with the strongest army in the Middle East, with the full support of the United States and the West, still tries to advocate for its legitimacy so many years after? Why is this lack of certainty by the state itself and whoever represents it that maybe its legitimacy is questioned, on the one hand? On the other hand, why the Palestinian case and cause, which is very simple in many ways and very easy to understand as a basic moral issue, still does not succeed to become a legitimate cause in so many places where decisions are made, where policies are pursued. I thought that this kind of conundrum needs not a soundbite answer, which usually we need to give under the pressure of media and so on, but maybe I need to go back in history and very slowly reconstruct the history of lobbying for Zionism to try and understand why today we are where we are. And this is why I apologize for the length of the book. I know that many people don't like to read books at all, and many people don't like to read long books. There's sometimes people who prefer just to look at the screen of the smartphone. It's not an SMS book. But I do hope that the patient will pay, because you need to really go step by step from the beginning to understand the longevity of the lobby, its effectiveness, but maybe hopefully also realize its deficiencies and weaknesses, so that we have a hopeful vision for the future and not just lament all the time what is true. The total imbalance of power on the ground, in the region, in the global system, that explains why we are where we are today. Another reason for the length of the book is the fact that I wanted to bring long citations from British and American politicians in particular, both those who supported Zionism, but also those who oppose Zionism. It's amazing to read statements by both sides of the argument from 1900 or 1905, which are really prophetic, in the sense of understanding what the support for a Jewish state in Palestine would do to the Palestinians and to the area as a whole, understanding what kind of complication it would create for the Jewish communities, wherever they are. So you have these people with, you know, ability, which is incredible, at a given moment in history, to see beyond the moment, to see into the future. And it gives you a sense, and I think, Anas, that connects well to what you were saying, that we are still in that historical chapter. It's not, we don't have a closure for that chapter. And I could call this chapter the Western idea that the problem of the Jews in the West can only be solved by colonizing Palestine at the expense of the Palestinians. And how would we continue to defend this horrible idea and give immunity to its practices and policies against the Palestinians, wherever they are? And although I was familiar myself with many chapters in the history, both of Palestine and of Zionism, I was still surprised to be reminded of certain stages in the progress of the lobbying for Zionism, which really ring true today and relevant today. For instance, the fact that Zionism began as an evangelical Christian project before it became a Jewish one. That the whole idea that the return of the Jews to Palestine is part of a divine scheme that will precipitate the second coming of the Messiah, the resurrection of the dead, and maybe the beginning of 1,000 years of Jesus's rule on earth. Now, it was not every evangelical stream in thinking that thought that way, but it was an important part of evangelical Christianity, beginning in Britain and transformed into the United States by people who at first you could call them theologians rather than politicians, but very soon some of them became politicians of importance, and they, especially in Britain, they provided a certain theological justification for a new imperial thinking, not just about Palestine, but of the whole Eastern Mediterranean, the Mashrek. Because the British basic view on the Eastern Mediterranean throughout the 19th century was that although the Ottoman Empire that ruled that area was in decline, it was better to keep it intact, because a disintegration of the empire would create a struggle for spoils among the European powers and could lead to something which would be called later on a world war, which in fact is what happened. But the pressure of those evangelical Christians who, together with British imperialists, who thought that it's time to cede from the Ottoman Empire the Eastern Mediterranean, brought together, first of all, a non-Jewish support for the idea of what they would call the return of the Jews to Palestine and the replacement of the Palestinian with a Jewish kingdom or state or republic, depends on who we are talking about. Now, it means that already throughout the 19th century, people were discussing the fate of Palestine and the Palestinians without the Palestinians being aware that they are becoming a regional project or even a global project of colonization. And I was surprised to see how much this kind of thinking influenced the early Jewish supporters of Zionism, because I would thought that this was kind of two discrete projects that had nothing to do with it. But then I read a diary by one of the most important early Zionist, Eliezer ben Yehuda, who reinvented the Hebrew language. He was very much influenced by evangelical Christianity and changed his mind about Zionism in the sense that he said, yes, we should redefine Judaism, not as a religion, but as a nationalism. But I think they're right. It should happen in Palestine and not anywhere else. So there was an impact of that kind of thinking the imperial thinking, the theological thinking coming from Christianity on the very nascent, very small number of Jewish intellectuals who thought that the best solution for anti-Semitism in Central and Eastern Europe was to create or establish a Jewish state in Palestine. So that's the beginning, which, as you can probably understand today, is not just an intellectual or an interesting forgotten chapter of the past. It's still a very relevant alliance that is still working today. By the way, not only in the United States, where we are all familiar with the term Christian Zionist as a lobby that supports Israel. You go to Sweden, you go to Denmark, you go to Norway. Christian Zionism is alive in Europe and in the United Kingdom as well as an idea that supports Israel unconditionally in the name of the same theology that began the whole Zionist project. To my surprise, when I was in Malaysia, I met leaders of the Christian community in Malaysia, and they also are very much under the influence of Christian Zionists in that respect. So this is an alliance of the past, which is still steadfast today. The second, again, note in the book that reminded me of things that I've forgotten and I thought are very relevant for today is the insistence of every leading figure, in the Anglo-Jewish community and also in some of the Western Jewish communities, people with status, with position, some of them ministers in cabinet, some of them important business figures in their society. I was surprised to be reminded that they made sure that everybody would understand that they themselves would never go to Palestine, that they felt safe in Britain, that they saw no reason whatsoever to create a Jewish state because they had a problem as an Anglo-Jewish community. And far worse, and more cynically, and more sinisterly, they said if there won't be a Jewish state in Palestine, the poor Jews that are subjected to anti-Semitism in Central and Eastern Europe would come to Britain, God forbid. And they would are poor, we would have to take care of them. After 1905, the sense was that these poor Jews are also Bolsheviks, so they would steal problems for Britain as a whole and the Jewish community at it. And therefore, it's quite incredible to go back to the material itself and to see it word by word written in explaining to British policymakers, German policymakers, so on, this is good for Europe because we don't want the poor East European Jews to come to the West or to the United States, when I started talking, looking for the origins of the pro-Zionist lobby in the United States. So this is important because, again, it sounds like a distant chapter in the past, but it's very much a relevant issue today, isn't it? I mean, the whole connection between the Anglo-Jewish community and Israel, and this whole walking on eggshells when we begin to talk earnestly and honestly and actually against racism, not because we are racist, that you cannot be an ambassador, an ambassadress for Israel, and at the same time claim that all you care is for the interests of the Anglo-Jewish community. And anybody who points out to this kind of connection is immediately branded as an anti-Semite, or in my case, as a self-hating Jew. This is something that we should not be afraid to talk about, because this is very, very important. I won't mention name, but if you are familiar with what goes on in the Labour Party now, a full lobbyist for Israel is going to be one of the most powerful member of the Labour Party. I don't want to get into names. It's not important. The name is not important. What is important that for 100 years, people who were part of the organization of the lobbying for Zionism, later for Israel, also played a very important role in British politics. And so no contradiction in representing the interests of a foreign country and a foreign state, and a state that commits crimes against humanity and war crimes, and at the same time serving civil servants or politicians of Britain. Everybody says, well, when you're going into this, you are going into the territory of conspiracies, and that leads us to the old accusations of anti-Semitism against the Jews. No, this is why we write books like this. This is why we insist that this is a scholarly work, pedantic work, that is not falling into any conspiracy theories, is just examining the evidence in history to show that this is a connection that is problematic, not just for the Palestinians, but also for the Jews in Britain. And they, I think we have now a younger generation, at least of American Jews, who fully comprehend and understand this problem and fully acknowledge that this has not served well the American Jewish community to be the ambassadors and ambassadress for Israel, and they just jettisoned their connection to Zionism, and many of them feel that in order to show where they are today, they also want to take full part in the solidarity movement with the Palestinians. So not just saying Judaism is not Zionism, our Judaism puts us in the forefront in the struggle for liberation and freedom in Palestine. A third point that I wanted, and I follow your clock very carefully here, so keep it alive. it helps me. I used to think that socialism or social democracy and labor movement in Britain would go together with universal values that I cherish. Human rights, civil rights, workers' rights. And it's only when I went into the history of the Labour Party before the creation of the State of Israel, and especially in the early years of statehood, when the Labour Friends of Israel were established in the early 1950s, that I realized how important was this, today I think we'll call it gaslighting, you know, this social democratic gaslighting. What do I mean by this? You have really the pillars of British socialism, really the pillars of British socialism, who, for instance, would definitely condemn apartheid in South Africa, fully supporting Israel to the extent that any attempt to show, as Radha and her friends would, any sympathy, empathy, a wish to with the Palestinians, a wish to represent the Palestinian cause, would immediately be destroyed by these particular leaders of socialism in Britain. It gives you some kind of a more profound and deeper understanding for the Jeremy Corbyn, or the attack on Jeremy Corbyn. It's not a new phenomenon. There are roots there of social democrats, by the way, not only in Britain, in Europe as a whole, providing a shield of immunity to Zionism in the name of social democratic principles. This is far worse than the right-wing support for Israel. The fascist right-wing support that Israel enjoys today and maybe enjoyed a bit in the past is easy to challenge, is easy to deal with, because you immediately say, you see who the allies are of this state, who is the allies of this ideology. But when the ideology that is being mentioned and quoted to explain why Israel is supported is one that you can identify with as a human being, then it becomes a bit more complicated. And it was very difficult, I think, for anybody challenging the support for Zionism and support for Israel when it came from either liberal or social democrat circles. And I wasn't aware of this, how deep it went into the Labour Party, even before the creation of the Conservative Friends of Israel, who are now the most important lobby for Israel in Britain, but how important the Labour Friends of Israel. Not to mention the specific outfits that joined the TUC, the Trade Union Council. The trade unions in Britain were giving affiliation to pre-state Zionist organization, whose role was before 1948 to advocate for Zionism, but the Israel did not dismantle them because it turned it into part of the lobbying for Zionism for Israel in Britain. So you had pure Zionist organization having full affiliation and membership in the TUC, while any attempt to even create, at the beginning, a solidarity circle with the Palestinians in the trade unions was rejected as political and unacceptable. Unbelievable if you go back to it. And this is a time when people already visited Palestine and Israel. It was at the time when people began to understand what was going on. Of course, it became a bit more difficult when it was easier to visit and easier to get information what was going on. But even then, it was not yet over for the Labour Party to show unconditional support for oppression, apartheid, colonization, ethnic cleansing, and nowadays, not to speak openly and bravely about the genocide in Palestine. Shame on them and shame on this leadership that doesn't even have one word to say. But it has an historical root for this, and I think it's very important. Finally, I think that I want also to be optimistic, because it's very clear that what I was talking about up to now is a huge, powerful alliance. First included Britain, then the United States, then multinational cooperation. The Palestinians really, were facing an alliance so powerful economically, politically, strategically, and it's all focused on the idea of this project of displacement and replacement, displacing the Palestinians and replacing them. It's almost incredible that they're still there, fighting, showing resilience and resistance. This is also what my book taught me once more, that how unbelievable is the fact that Palestine and the Palestinians are still there. It's not taken for granted. But what brings me hope, and for me, hope, I want to explain that nobody misunderstand what I mean for me. Hope for me is the end of Israel and the creation of a free Palestine from the river to the sea. What brings me hope is the fact that the powerful lobby and the alliance were very effective when it comes to politics from above. They, from the very early on, they understand that all they have to do is follow politicians at the early stages of their career, making sure that they are allies in a later stage in their career, using money, influence, intimidation if needed, in order to get whether the American or the British political system to abide by their demands. However, they find it very difficult and always found it very difficult to deal with the civil society. They don't know how to deal with alternative media today. They have no idea how to deal with it. They don't know how to deal with civil society, with communal action, with boycott initiatives, with divestment initiatives. All their methodology, all the weaponry, all the armory that they have is useless, it seems, against people. That should give us hope. And the hope is that probably this is not the only issue in which the politicians of this particular era are not representing us well. I don't remember as an historian at an age like this when politics, and I'm generalizing, of course, that politicians were of such a low caliber, intellectually, morally, corrupt, shallow, reductionist, people who have very little to offer their society apart from their own careers. It doesn't matter which party. It's really the age of the lack of any status for the politicians. So their ideas of how to deal with global warming, how to deal with poverty, how to deal with issues that really trouble people are not very interesting and are not very successful and are not very effective because they don't care about these issues. They care about their own careers. It's not surprising that also their ideas about Palestine are irrelevant and are harmful and negative. So we should hope that when people struggle against this lobby, they're also struggling against other lobbies that make their life miserable and disable them to solve problems of poverty, ecological danger, injustices in society beyond the question of Palestine. I think this explains why so many people are galvanized behind the Palestine question as symbolizing struggle against injustices anywhere else in the world as well. And Palestine is an indication that there is a different kind of politics that we would wish for ourselves, for our next generations. And that's why so many hopes are pinned on the Palestinian liberation movement, sometimes probably unreasonably, actually, that Palestine would be the paragon state that all the other failed decolonized world was unable to fulfill. But it explains, because this isn't a demand for a different kind of politicians and a different kind of the idea, what is universal justice? This is the big challenge the ICJ and the ICC are having. It's not a coincidence that for the first time, they at least provided a stage for what people think about Palestine and not governments, if you think about it. And they did it intentionally. I talked with them, some of them. They did it intentionally. They wanted to show that international tribunals are also listening to people, not just to the politics of power. Hopefully, this is just the beginning of a process that would lead for a better world, first of all for the Palestinians, and then for all of us. Thank you.
Pape's new book is Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic, and it is now available wherever books are sold. We are out of time. I wanted to remind you that This Week in Palestine is available as a podcast now on all major podcast platforms. It is typically released on Tuesdays, and what I love about the podcast is that it has show notes. So in this show's notes, you will see links to the IMEU's website, as well as its policy project website, and where to find the podcast This Is Palestine. The notes will also contain a YouTube video link to Ilan Pape's full talk. Thank you so much for spending this time with us as we continue the fight for Palestinian liberation. I'll see you next week.